Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Daughters and Sons Hour. My name is Joe Donovan. I'll be your host tonight. Our show is a monthly conversation on topics of concern to daughters and sons of parents with mental illnesses. Tonight, we discuss post-traumatic stress disorder and its impact on military children, family, children in military families. My guest tonight is Michelle Sherman, PhD. Dr. Sherman is a licensed clinical psychologist who has dedicated her career to supporting veterans and their families with mental illness, trauma, and PTSD. She has worked in the VA system for almost 20 years now and has developed family education programs that have been used nationally across in the VA across the country. Are you on, Michelle?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Joe.
Okay. I guess to start off with is, you know, this is an area where you've done a lot of research and have developed a lot of materials around it. And I guess I want to start off with just a question of how you got involved and got interested in this topic for your research.
Sure. Yeah, you bet. Well, as you mentioned, I'm privileged to have been in the VA system for almost 20 years and have historically the VA's focus has been, you know, on the veteran, which makes sense in supporting veterans in all parts of their life and ages and things. But certainly there's a great deal of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD among veterans. And very frankly, Joe, where I kind of started to develop some of my ideas 15, 17 years ago was just being aware of all of the families sitting in the waiting room, the spouses, the partners, the parents, the children, and the real commonalities in their needs and experiences. And so really I went to the literature, the research literature, the self-help resources, and try to see, you know, what's out there so we can help these young people and families, very quickly became aware that, gosh, there's really not very much out there to support these people. And I really thought pretty strongly that there was an opportunity to make a difference and support these families dealing with PTSD and other mental illnesses, which really prompted me in my VA career to develop, as you mentioned, a couple of family education programs and parenting resources and toolkits and things of that nature to help veterans and their family members to really be able to cope effectively together as a team in understanding and coping effectively with post-traumatic stress disorder and its impact on the family. And then in my personal life, that is really where I have focused on my efforts on supporting the young people. And I've really had the privilege of interacting with young people in a range of settings, certainly both in the VA hospital sort of setting, but also at welcome home camps and research opportunities and things of that nature. So my interest really has come from a clinical one in seeing some of these families struggle, both in my office as I would provide couples and family therapy, as well as in general clinic settings, and secondly, an awareness of the gap in resources to help families deal with this really is what sparked my initial interest.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's, I guess, do a little overview of what PTSD is, because I think by now everyone's heard of it. They think they know what it is. But as far as like kind of the history of how the diagnosis was developed and how we've learned over the years.
That's a great question.
How to support
individuals. It's certainly a term that's thrown around a lot and is an important one to be clear on what it actually means. Post-traumatic stress disorder was not actually termed or coined that until 1980. However, it's clear that the phenomenon has been around for a very long time. You can look in historical books such as the Bible or even Shakespearean writing. You can look at Greek and Roman mythology and all sorts of places and find symptoms or descriptions of the symptoms that today we call PTSD. In previous wars, it has been called things like a shell shock and soldier's heart and things, but it really wasn't coined the name PTSD until 1980. One of the important things about the diagnosis of PTSD is when we talk about T, the trauma, we're not using the term like we use in everyday language, like, gosh, you know, I had a really bad job at my test today, or I got in an argument with my spouse, you know, that was really a traumatic day. You know, with PTSD, we're really not talking about that. The definition, according to the diagnostic manual, really is it needs to be experiencing or witnessing a death or near-death experience or a sexual violence of some kind. So it really does need to be involving some sort of pretty significant life-altering or sexual trauma sort of event. And then beyond the exposure to the event, which incidentally, about 50% of all people experience some sort of trauma along those lines at some point in their life. And most people, Joe, I know that you'll agree with me when I say most people who have experienced traumatic things do not go on to develop PTSD. You know, most are resilient due to their family support or friends or spirituality or perhaps mental health professionals, clergy, I mean, inner strength, all sorts of things. Most people exposed to trauma do not develop PTSD. There certainly is a handful, and approximately 8% of people in our country at some point will go on to develop PTSD. But most people experience traumatic events do not develop that. They may develop some other difficulties, perhaps depression, perhaps alcohol, drug abuse, anger problems, these sorts of things. But the prevalence of PTSD is actually only approximately 8%. So in addition to the trauma, the exposure to the traumatic event, other symptoms that commonly occur with PTSD include some of what we term re-experiencing symptoms, in which the person, and please forgive me if I say veteran, I work primarily with veterans, but certainly PTSD affects all people, not just veterans. But when the individual relives the event, it could be through nightmares. It could be through flashbacks, when you actually feel like the event is happening again. Most commonly, it's re-experienced in what we call intrusive thoughts, which all of a sudden, the memory pops into your mind, sometimes for no clear reason. But it can be very much like you're haunted by the event in different ways. A second category of symptoms is what we call avoidance. This can actually have two parts. One is you can avoid any reminders, anything that reminds you of the trauma. For example, many of our Vietnam veterans really have a difficult time going in Vietnamese restaurants or places where they might encounter Vietnamese people. Even though they know they're safe here in the United States, and the Vietnam War was many years ago, that's a very strong trigger for them. Or let's say, for example, someone was attacked in a certain park or part of the neighborhood, and they may want to avoid it and not go to those parts of town. So part of avoidance is avoiding triggers or reminders. The other part of avoidance can involve avoiding intimacy or close emotional connections with people. The other category in PTSD involves increased emotion. And what I mean by that is it can be strong experiences of anger. Certainly we know issues of domestic violence and things like that are elevated among people with PTSD. So it can be increased anger, but also we think a lot about increased levels of anxiety, which can be manifested in hypervigilance, meaning you're always aware of what's going on around you. So again, if you're in a combat zone, that's functional. That's actually a good thing, but that's hard to just turn off when you get off the plane and coming home. So always aware. Oftentimes people with PTSD, you know, really have a hard time with going to loud, busy grocery stores, or they really have a hard time in movie theaters, where they'll sit with their backs to the wall, or in restaurants, they may often want to sit where they can see everything going around. These sorts of things can make them really feel on edge and have a difficult time relaxing. Another anxiety symptom is what we term increased startle reaction. So if there's a noise, they can really jump and have a very strong visceral reaction to the sound. So all of these are kind of increased emotional responses to things. You know, an example I commonly give is that a very large, wonderful church in the city I used to live was doing some outreach to veterans and their families, which, again, I think is great. And what they did was they offered for a welcome home event for these veterans and families a night at the local ballpark, the ball stadium, on the 4th of July, which, if you think much about PTSD, you'll quickly realize that's really not very sensitive to veterans' needs or feelings. You know, veterans with PTSD don't like to be in large ballparks with lots of noise and sounds and people behind them, and they certainly don't like loud noises and fireworks. So I say that as an example just to be thoughtful of understanding more about PTSD can help our efforts to support these families. So those are the basic symptoms. Again, most people with trauma do not develop PTSD, and I don't know if we're going to get to this or not, but certainly there are very great treatments that are available to help people cope with PTSD more effectively and even not meet the criteria, not have the symptoms anymore. So there's certainly good reason to be hopeful. But that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of PTSD and its history and what it is.
Okay, thank you. The next thing I wanted to really get into is, again, these recent conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and some of the kind of cultural differences that have happened with these, because in this case we do have, again, as opposed to like Vietnam, you know, this time, you know, it's an all-volunteer force. You've got the multiple deployments, you both active duty and reservists, and more and more women were also deployed than any before. And so there's just so a lot of this really had an impact, especially since, you know, we've also had the issue of military families in that a lot of times both father and mother are in the military. And so there's, it can really throw, that whole thing can really create a lot of challenges for the family and the children within those families.
Joe, you're exactly right. Yeah, you mentioned many of the distinctive features of how these wars are different from other wars, that I think you actually captured them very, very well. Certainly the increasing role of women, both in military and in combat roles. We don't know much in terms of the research, actually, about the experience of moms being deployed to combat zones, but is an area really needing further research. As you mentioned, about half the people that have been deployed in these wars do come from Guard and Reserve, which are pretty distinct population, you know, tending to be older, more likely to be married, more likely to have children, more likely to have established jobs, and frankly, typically don't have the amount, recency of training that our active duty personnel do, because these folks, again, you know, do their summer camps and, you know, their weekend warrior sorts of things, but they have full-time jobs and families, and so typically don't have the intensity of recent training as the active duty people, and at times when they come home, experience difficulties reintegrating back into their old jobs or schools or things like that. So it's a very different force. The ages of our personnel deployed really is a bimodal distribution. We have both the younger folks, younger typical Army personnel, for example, and we really do have this cohort of folks who are a little bit older who do tend to be more the Guard and Reserve component. So we need to be thoughtful about the folks that we talk about. As you alluded to, this is actually the most studied set of wars we've ever had. There have been a number of longitudinal research projects, meaning we don't only just look at people when they get home, but we look at them before they go. There's even research with folks during, while they are deployed, and then when they get home and over time when they get home. So there really is quite a bit of very good quality research being done, particularly on the service members, certainly some also on the children, certainly some also on the partners, but there's a tremendous amount of research going on. And similar to my previous comment, you know, it's actually amazing if you think about some of the experiences that some of these men and women and families have, that actually so few of them do to go on to develop difficulties. Most people do not. Most people truly are resilient and do well. Certainly some of them do, and they deserve every bit of time, attention, and support that we can provide. But overall, actually, most people really do well.
Okay.
Was there a part of that you wanted me to kind of drill down in more, or because you really hit the many of the highlights of, you know, the different war zone. You know, the most common cause of physical injury in this in these wars has been the roadside bombs, which are called IEDs, intermittent explosive devices. You know, but certainly with a much higher percentage of people who are surviving significant physical health injuries that perhaps in previous wars, due to lack of medical advances and increased time basically to get people to health care, certainly would have had a higher rate of folks dying. Now many of them are surviving, which is generating a whole population of service members who are needing a whole range of care, certainly some of them with traumatic brain injuries, which is termed one of the signature injuries of this war, along with PTSD. You know, so certainly we are seeing a number of folks with perhaps might be some chronic difficulties. Incidentally, the research in PTSD in general shows that about 30% of those with PTSD do go on to develop a chronic form. But again, there are certainly effective treatments that are available. But they're not always easy. And I think it's important to say that caveat, that although there are very clearly evidence-based therapies for PTSD, they're difficult, and unfortunately we have a bit of a difficult problem with keeping people in therapy, retention rates, because some of the treatments, although effective, can be difficult. So there's very, very good reason to be hopeful, but there certainly are a number of obstacles to overcome and issues to keep working on.
Yes, and that's something I've noticed too, just because, you know, I am a veteran, although I was serving a long time ago. I have tried to stay aware of the common and current challenges that a lot of younger individuals have gone through. I think one of the big questions for me really gets into again the issue of how is this impacting children, mm-hmm. because we do have there is the multiple deployments.
Right.
And again, so, you know, that's one thing. And then also, you know, again, and which does not necessarily have, which will have some impact in the child's lives. But, and then also, again, when you do have those issues of those who may develop the chronic PTSD and family life there. And so I think there's, you know, I want to kind of get a picture of, you know, what life looks like for these young people. And I guess that's about it.
Okay. So kind of a question of how the PTSD can impact the family. And I certainly can share some kind of research in general with that, both regarding veterans and the more general population. But really one of the kind of foot stompers or things I want to emphasize is that fortunately and hopefully most children and families really do well and are resilient due to the support of other family members or due to the support of communities or schools or churches or mental health professionals. I mean, there are all sorts of people that come in and provide support to these children. So as we kind of look at, you know, we've got the whole veteran and military population. We've got the subset of people who have, you know, psychological sorts of difficulties, including but not limited to PTSD. And then we've got, you know, the impact of the subset, those who have impacts on their children. I guess just like with families dealing with other mental illnesses, yes, there certainly is some impact on the children. And to determine exactly what it is not possible for any one particular family. But I can certainly make some broad brushstroke sorts of comments and then cite some of the literature that we know. If we're thinking about the symptoms I just mentioned a few minutes ago in terms of, you know, the re-experiencing, the avoidance sorts of phenomenon and the increased emotion sort of reaction, kids can be affected by all of those, but actually let me just describe a few of them here. When we talk about avoidance, let's say the mom or the dad or the stepmom or someone really is not able to tolerate crowds. Well, for the child, that may mean, well, gosh, my mom can never come to my basketball games. or can't come to my dance recitals, or I can't have kids over to my house because, you know, they're yelling and screaming and playing may affect my mom or dad. And so children often struggle, say, well, what's going on? Why, you know, why can't I have friends over? Why will mom and dad not go to my event? You know, am I bad or do they not love me? And kids can feel uncared for, unloved, confused. And as we know really well, at times kids blame themselves and think, gosh, you know, I did something wrong, or what happened that is really causing a problem in our family, and what did I do wrong? And so we can see children dealing with the effects of the parental avoidance sort of thing on the reminders, but we can probably most glaringly see the impact of the parents' avoidance of intimacy or connection, and that children will describe, gosh, I feel like my parents is there physically, but they're not really there. You know, they are not able to get down and play with me and making Legos. They're not able to, you know, go on a walk with me and talk about, you know, breaking up with my boyfriend or whatever else. You know, they're physically there, but not mentally there. And again, especially if the child was old enough before the trauma that the child can recognize a difference in the parent, children often are confused and saying, you know, what's going on? What did I do? When is my mom or dad going to be back like they used to be? And really kind of struggling and feeling alone and confused with what's going on. So we certainly see the impact of both kinds of avoidance. We also can definitely see the impact of the parents' strong emotions, in particular anger. There certainly is research looking at increased risks of people living with PTSD in terms of domestic violence, spouse abuse, things of that nature. So we do know there's some risk factors for family violence. Incidentally, if we just take a moment looking at the issue of family violence, there have been a few research studies looking at children being at higher risk for being physically abused or neglected with military families. But what I want to point out here, Joe, is that the person perpetrating the violence in these cases is actually usually not the service member, but it's actually the at-home parent, which if we need to think systemically about these families, the at-home parent often is overwhelmed, needing to do two parents' jobs, maybe trying to, you know, work two jobs to make extra money while their loved one is gone. But actually we need to think that these children may also be affected, in particular with deployment, of the at-home parent stress, and even if we're not dealing with a veteran situation, the broader stress on the family and dealing with PTSD. So the increased risk for violence or difficulties in the home is one, I think, to be aware of when we're thinking about some of these challenges for the children. When we look at the research, first of all, at children in general whose parent has a PTSD, we do find an increased risk for these children for a range of issues, including anxiety, including broader mental health concerns, depression. We look at behavioral disorders or problems or things. So we do see an increased risk for that, either based on asking the children, you know, the children's report, or if you ask the parent. There was a meta-analysis, which is a review of a number of studies, that found that parents who had PTSD were at 1 to 2 times higher risk for saying that at least one of their children had some sort of anxiety disorder or depression as well. So in the, you know, public in general, we certainly do know that there are some difficulties there. In terms of children of parents who have PTSD from these wars, there actually isn't a lot of research on that particular segment of the population right now. It's growing. But if we were to, you know, extrapolate or guess from previous populations, certainly there's been research on children of POWs, children of Vietnam-era veterans a little bit. We could hypothesize that some of them would be at higher risk for some of these difficulties. But again, most are not going to develop long-term difficulties and will do well.
Okay. And I guess the next thing is, and you mentioned it, and it's one of those things I think that really does need to be shared, is that, again, with the nature of these conflicts, is because there was so much other resources out there for families, and you know, because there are many different organizations out there that have developed to be supportive of both the service members and their families. And I guess I wanted to kind of get through, you know, what kind of supports are out there for but the families in general, as well as young people, as far as you know, where they're able to be able to share their experiences, or you know, really learn kind of how to work, you know, with whatever challenges they're facing.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I couldn't agree more that there's just been an explosion of resources that are available and that are trying to reach out to military families, including those dealing with PTSD. And they range the gamut from, you know, summer camp sorts of activities to family retreats to Facebook sorts of groups, you know, social media platforms to websites to workshops to classes. I mean, there are so many things now. But my perspective, and this is just my opinion, Joe, is that there's considerable variability across them. You know, in some places that may be really rich with resources and a lot going on, other places people may be more isolated and distant and not able to avail themselves of some of the resources. Furthermore, as a researcher, you know, I'm a researcher, I'm pretty interested in knowing if things work. And actually, way back, probably 6 or 7 years ago, I co-chaired the American Psychological Association's Presidential Task Force on Understanding Military Families. One of the things we strongly suggested at that point was we need to evaluate what we're doing. And so although there definitely are a wide range from, you know, grassroots community organizations up through, you know, joining forces at the level of Mrs. Obama, you know, and everything in between, there's not been a lot of funding or effort dedicated to evaluating if these things work. And what's done in one state is typically very, very different from what's done and available in another state. There's really not a gold standard that has emerged. There certainly are some family programs that are done at more than one place, but they're certainly limited in their focus. And if we look particularly at impact of PTSD on children and parenting, there's very, very little done particularly on that, actually. So one of my frequent calls is the need to, you know, evaluate and research what we're doing. You know, is it helpful? Now, there are a few exceptions. For example, there is a website called Military Kids Connect. Now, that is not specific to PTSD, but that is a website that's been developed through the VA and the DOD that really is trying to reach out to military children and provide an opportunity for support. And they are doing, I know, some evaluation of that. So I think that's, you know, very positive. But most of the resources that are out there don't have a large research base and definitely could benefit from attending, you know, devoting money and resources to showing that they work. So it's going to be a role model for other places to do things. But certainly, you know, there's the FOCUS program, which is for families kind of in general. There's an ADAPT parenting program. Michigan has another one kind of for families. But these all tend to be more focused on kind of families in general and really not focused on PTSD. That's really why in my VA career I kind of created these resources to help families, adults, understand and cope with PTSD, and why in my personal life, along with my mom, we created, you know, our first book, which is called Finding My Way, A Teen's Guide to Living with a Parent Who Has Experienced Trauma. And it really is an interactive workbook that can be a basis for a therapy or a class to help teenagers understand and cope with their parent and cope with their own feelings about trauma or PTSD. That book is not specific to the military. It's about all different kinds of trauma. But actually, we're really fortunate that the National Guard picked up that book and sent it to all the National Guard units across the country, because they were also aware that there were really few resources available for these teenagers. So we're trying to make a dent in supporting that area, but there's really very, very little done. Another huge population that has really been ignored is the children of veterans. Now, we talk about when folks are service members in active duty and Guard and Reserve and their families, but when they cross that bridge over into the veteran population, there's been very, very little awareness. The VA can't even tell us how many children of veterans there are. They don't have a way of tracking that. You know, the active duty component certainly tracks those things carefully, but the VA cannot even tell us how many children of veterans they are or the impact on children or anything of that nature. So there's a wide open area to improve our understanding of the impact of PTSD on children in the veteran population. So there's a long way really you can learn and growing. I think I had mentioned to you when we talked about setting up this call that a few of us are just completing now a pretty exciting research project looking at veterans who have PTSD who are parents and asking them what is their experience as a parent, what are some of their strengths, what are some of their challenges, how is the VA supporting them and how can they help them in dealing with their PTSD. And unfortunately, many of them are saying, my VA docs don't even ask me if I have kids, much less what it's like for my kids when, on the 4th of July, I dive under the coffee table or, I can't leave the house because I'm, really overwhelmed with anxiety or the reminders or whatever else. So we're just starting to do some research in that area, and we'll be developing some resources for veteran parents to help them talk to their children about PTSD and things of that nature. But it really is a pretty wide open area that we have a lot more we need to learn so we can better support veteran parents who have PTSD and thus, in turn, support their children as well.
I kind of assumed that it was this challenge. A couple of things, I heard, and that was, again, getting back into the issue of where resources are. I'm assuming that you'll see more in areas near the military bases, near active duty,
right.
Less
yep.
Out in the rest of the world where all the reservists and the Guard are.
Yep, you're totally right. Yep, exactly.
Who don't live near the base when they're not serving. And so, you have to have trying to create supports and information for them because they live everywhere else. And I guess I didn't realize just how little information the VA had. I'm not surprised, but...
Yep, they really don't collect that information on a routine basis. Their focus and their funding is all about supporting veterans, and that is kind of their what they see as their focus, which I certainly appreciate. But one of the things that I believe, and this is just an opinion statement, this is just Michelle Sherman's opinion, is that if you are a parent dealing, for example, with PTSD, and you're feeling really crummy about your relationship with your child, that affects how you feel about yourself. And if we're able to empower veterans who are parents to feel more effective in parenting, to feel closer to their children, to be able to help talk about some of these difficult elephants in the living room sorts of things, that will actually in turn help their mental health as well as help their children and families. So my opinion, again, just my opinion, is that I think these things all go together, and I think the role of parent has really been neglected and is one that we can, collectively work to better understand and support veterans in their role as parents.
Oh, yes, and I had this discussion in the past with some of my former guests. A few shows back, we had Joanne Nicholson, who's done a lot of research primarily on those who receive services from mental health services from the public, Medicaid, SSI, and SSDI stuff, and so been very big there. But again, we also have to realize that we've got this parallel system with the VA that also needs to have this same kind of mentality about family recovery.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's a great parallel. Yeah, and certainly not all veterans go to the VA. Many prefer and choose and use their insurance and whatever else to go to, the private sector or the public sector or things like that. But certainly there are a fair number who do choose to use the VA for their health care. So it's a large organization that supports many, many people. And I think it takes time for large institutions such as like that to change. In the almost 20 years I've been there, it actually has changed a lot in terms of doing much more for families than they had before. But I certainly think there's an opportunity for growth and to do more. But we also need research to guide that and funding to support that research such so we can better understand what's going on in these families so we can better help them.
Okay. I'm going to take a minute here to check to see if anyone out there listening would like to call in. Our number to call in is area code 646-564-9557. That's 646 564-9557. I guess right now I want to talk about your books. You mentioned briefly that you and your mother have collaborated on three books now.
Yes, exactly. Yes, you're right. Hard to believe.
And can you give me a little history of how that developed, what the different books are as far as audience, and why you chose to, and what your hopes are, and all that fun stuff?
Sure, you bet. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, it was back in, 2005, so a long time ago now. And I said to my mom, hey, do you want to write some books, really just being aware of some gaps and resources for young people? And she actually said yes, and she's a teacher. And so the two of us have really joined forces, just frankly as a mother-daughter, a teacher-psychologist team, and have created what we hope are some resources that really help fill gaps. We have no funding. This didn't come from any sort of grant or anything. It was just really our ministry, although our books are not spiritual or religious in any way, shape, or form. They really come from a place of a true desire to help families dealing with some challenges. And so the first one was the one that we've kind of already mentioned, the one for teens whose parent has experienced trauma, and that one's called Finding My Way. It's a teen's guide to living with a parent who's experienced trauma. And I'll describe that one and the second one in tandem. The second one is called I'm Not Alone, a teen's guide to living with a parent who has a mental illness. And that one is focused on parental depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. And both of those books, Finding My Way and I'm Not Alone, are interactive workbooks. They're not things we expect a teenager would run up to Barnes & Noble and pick out on their own. I think they're not even available at Barnes & Noble. But they're really things that we anticipate would be worked through with a trusted adult. Again, perhaps these are the group therapy curriculum or in some sort of class or activity or psychotherapy. But they really aim to provide information about PTSD or mental illness in a teen-friendly sort of way. We don't use all the psychobabble and things like that. And we have lots of examples from teens and families who are actually living the experience of dealing with trauma or mental illness in their family. And so they can share what worked for them and what helped. So part of it is just the educational part of it. And then a large part of it is helping the teenager cope with their thoughts and feelings. It could be, you know, what can I do when my mom is acting in a way that I'm so confused, or when I'm really angry because they're not able to be there for me, or they were acting in a difficult way. What do I tell my friends? What should I or do I want to tell my friends? Who can I count on? Who's there for me to support me in the difficult times? All these sorts of things, and they both have lists of resources to help children better understand, and if they want more information, where they can go and look for it. So those are the first two, and then the other, and the third and final one is actually specific for youth whose parent deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, and it's called My Story, and it's blogs by four military teens. It's about their experiences and thoughts and feelings before, during, and after their parents' deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan. And this one is a little less focused on trauma or mental illness, but it's more focused on common teen experiences throughout the deployment history. We're really pleased that the Military Child Education Coalition uses some of our books in some of their trainings, and people have contacted me and are using it in actually different places all across the country. And so we really have been excited and delighted that they can help fill a gap in the resources and hope they continue to be useful workbooks and documents and really help teens know. Like you said, some may be even living in a very rural area and don't know any other military kids in their family or don't understand, or no one's talking about this PTSD thing, to get it in these kids' hands so they can know they're truly not alone. There's good reason to be hopeful and give them some practical tools to help with cope with some of these challenges. That's what really our books are. Again, they're not available at Barnes & Noble or Amazon or things, but I think, Joe, it's on your website. It's just at the seedsofhopebooks.com website, or you can certainly contact Joe or get through to me, but those are our resources for teenagers.
All right, thank you. Okay, one other topic I wanted to bring up, which is a very difficult one for a lot of people, is the high rate of suicide that's taking place with our people who've served recently, and
mm-hmm.
trying to get a sense of, you know, what are those rates and how is that affecting families and children, and is there any kind, what kind of research or, you know, what do we know about this, because it is a major issue that gets some attention sometimes, but probably not as much as it needs to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Joey, I couldn't agree with you more that it is a significant problem. And if you look at even just the popular media in terms of it's demonstrating the increasing rates of suicide attempts and suicide completions, it is a significant societal problem. In terms of what may be, you know, contributing to that, certainly I think there are hypotheses that one of the most common precipitants or triggers for self-harm behavior, and they kind of, you know, track this over time to try to understand it, is actually relationship problems, and breakup of relationship, a divorce, those sorts of things. And that, as we've been discussing in our discussion tonight, that certainly that can be part of PTSD, can be part of repeated deployments. But we do believe that a fair number of self-harm behavior or suicide can be related to relationship problems, which further circles back kind of one of our themes in our discussion tonight is the importance of supporting the whole family. So certainly that can contribute, certainly considerable rates of depression, certainly high rates of alcohol and drug abuse, perhaps some impulsivity that can go along with traumatic brain injury and other issues. You know, so there are a lot of things that can contribute to it. The high operational tempo of the quick pace at which some service members are deployed in home again, the high exposure to trauma. You know, certainly it depends a lot on when people were deployed and where they were and things of that nature. But some of the early research, even out by Charles Hogan, things back in 2004, showed, this was a survey of about 900 Army soldiers, that showed the rates of exposure to what we would certainly call traumatic events was very, very high, with very high percentages seeing, you know, human remains, seeing children being responsible for the death of an enemy. You know, and sometimes there have been really quite high rates of trauma exposure. And then, again, if they come home and perhaps some reintegration challenges, these can all contribute to some of the issues of thoughts about suicide and, again, relationship problems that can contribute to it. My perspective, my awareness is that certainly the Department of Defense has been working very hard to try to overcome the stigma of asking for help. There are a lot of media campaigns, both in VA and DOD, things such as, you know, it takes the strength of a warrior to ask for help. There's a program through the National Center for PTSD called About Face, which is actually service members and veterans videotaped and sharing their experiences of, you know, how I knew I had PTSD, how it impacted my family, treatment I got, and things like that. So, you know, trying to have testimonials of high-ranking officials saying it's okay to get help, we're not going to hold this against you, making it less stigmatizing to access that help. I mean, there's certainly many efforts, I believe, that are going on and are important to continue. I think part of your question was, how does suicide and those sorts of things affect the family? I cannot cite off the top of my head, I'm not aware of any research with Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and their suicide and impact on their children, or their partners for that matter, actually. I could be overlooking or missing something, but I would say with pretty decent confidence, I'm not certainly aware of any large-scale research or things that has been done with them. Certainly be an important area of research to better our understanding. My sense in general in terms of the impact of suicide in families is that it certainly can be significant. The loss is great regardless, but then if you compound it with the form of death in terms of the loved one ending their own life, it can be very confusing and upsetting for everyone in the family, certainly including children. And again, with children often blaming themselves, you know, if I was only a better little boy or a better little girl, then mom or dad wouldn't have done this. Confusion, feeling abandoned, feeling angry, you know, all of the kind of ripple effects that we can think of. And certainly there are some programs, such as the TAPS program and others that are available to support families after the loss of a service member or a veteran by all sorts of different reasons. including but not limited to suicide. Again, there are camps, there are programs of activities for children and things to support them. But I am not aware of a large amount of rigorous research available on this topic at this time. But in summary, you know, I certainly agree that it's a significant problem and one that will need to continue to receive a lot of funding and effort. Certainly, I know there have been expectations or hopes or precedents set out by high-ranking leaders that they want to, you know, eliminate suicide. They really want making significant efforts and dedicating a lot of funding to try to reduce or eradicate this problem. But it's a complex societal one with lots of contributing factors. It's very, very hard to determine if any one person will make any sort of action, and there still is free will. So I think it's difficult to go quite to that extremes, but certainly there are, you know, a lot of people interested and dedicated and doing a lot of research on suicide in general, for sure, and certainly suicide among service members and veterans. But the specific angle you're talking about the impact of that on children, I'm not aware of any research on that.
Okay. Well, we've already been going on for 45 minutes now, so we've got 15 minutes left. So the time does fly.
Yes, it does.
So is there any question that I haven't asked? Anything else that you think we need to, the audience needs to hear on this topic that I just hadn't thought about?
You know, I think you asked lots of good questions. I mean, one of my kind of foot stomper sorts of things is celebrating the spirit of resilience. You know, really, that so many families are struggling with different things, you know? I mean, if someone in the family is dealing with an addiction, you know, if they're dealing with unemployment, if they're dealing with deployment or trauma, have all sorts of different kinds, physical health problems. You know, there are so many ways that all families struggle, honestly, with different things. Mental illness, poverty, homelessness. I mean, that really runs the gamut in terms of challenges that families face. And most children, although affected, of course, do not go on to develop, you know, long-term chronic difficulties and are really able to rise, you know, above. If we look at mental illness, of course, there's children do have higher risk just due to genetic loading. But even there, you know, they are certainly at higher risk, but most of them don't go on to develop significant difficulties either. So I think part of what we want to do is celebrate the resilience of the human spirit and really talk about what is working among those children and families that are working well together and how can we learn from that, as well as support those that are struggling. So I think, you know, a great deal of progress has been made in understanding and supporting these families in research and policy and efforts, again, everywhere from grassroots to, you know, national campaigns. I mean, you look at programs like, you know, Give an Hour that provides, you know, free counseling for service members or veterans or family members dealing with these things. You know, you look at Military OneSource that has, again, a tremendous compilation of resources that are available. Many people are trying to do outreach and support these families in different ways. But we certainly have some ways to improve and things to better understand. They're even doing a fair bit of prevention sort of things, drawing upon positive psychology for our service members to try to strengthen them, you know, before they go into difficult situations, combat situations and others, to try to decrease the likelihood of developing PTSD, which I, again, certainly celebrate those efforts and try to understand through a research perspective what's working and what's not. But, you know, with all of these efforts, I think we're making good progress. And even with, you know, the drawdown in Afghanistan and the end of the war in Iraq, although these perhaps are going to be abating or coming to a close, there will always be probably future wars and activities. So we can learn as much as we can from these families, men and women, and how we can learn and then improve and be ready and prepared for future operations that may arise.
Okay. You did mention one thing there that I hadn't thought about, and that is kind of the prevention side. That, mm-hmm. You know, the thought of, you know, we know now, even before people are deployed, that there is that risk that that they can develop the trauma, and how to prepare them to for that, and I wonder if you had any more on that you can discuss.
Sure. Yeah, there are a number of things. Psychologist Martin Seligman is the one who coined the term learned optimism, which is just basically the flip-flop of learned helplessness. Learned optimism is when I encounter something difficult in my life, because we all do, of course, every day, from little things to big things. It's part of the human condition. You know, how can we interpret that and put a hopeful or a positive spin on something that I've got support, I can handle it, I'm strong, positive self sorts of statements that I can be optimistic in the face of challenge instead of turn toward despair or pessimism and things or helplessness. How can I be active and be able to grow and move through the experience rather than get stuck, which certainly can be part of what PTSD and haunted by the past. And so based on this theory by Dr. Seligman and others, one of the things that the Army's done is something called a Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program, which is really taking these philosophies and ideas and imbuing them into educational services for service members, for some for families, and really trying to strengthen them to see if that might prevent the development or the severity of some of the war-related difficulties people have. I've not really seen any research on that. Perhaps some exist, but I don't think it's been extensive. But I think the jury's out in terms of what this might show in terms of the short- or long-term effectiveness. But the more that we can strengthen and grow the resilience of people before they encounter potentially difficult things, gosh, that would be wonderful as a way of decreasing the impact, the negative impact, both on service members, veterans, and on their families. So I think it's a science that's growing. And again, different branches do different things, and we need more research to show that it's working, but it certainly is a growing area of popularity.
Okay. Finished with all my questions, and I think I'll thank you for joining me. If you have any more to add, this is your time.
Okay, well, I think that's about all that what came to mind here at first, and I appreciate the opportunity, and hope the information was helpful and interesting, and I would sure love to hear back from people if people had other thoughts or questions as they emerge. I know that you have a way of getting a hold of me, Joe, and I'd be happy to connect or dialogue as things goes along, and certainly as time goes along, as we create these, they'll be free, you know, online kind of parenting toolkits to help parents with PTSD, talk to their kids about PTSD and things of that nature. Certainly would be happy to share that. You know, also the DOD and VA has a free online toolkit about parenting. It's not specific to PTSD, but, you know, there are a number of these resources that are growing and available. So if people have specific questions, I'd certainly be happy to field those. You can just shoot them to me, shoot them to Joe, and I'd be happy to respond in that way. But I appreciate your interest in this important topic, and again, I thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, and we'll be back next month. Good night, everyone.